Well, so good having Brad here. I was saying in the first service, you know, we just finished First Timothy and are talking about this letter from Timothy's, well, it's a mentor to his mentee, however you say that. Paul writing to Timothy, a young pastor in Ephesus, a pastor that is maybe, in this case, in a little over his head, and just these wonderful words of encouragement and vision and perspective being given. And I was feeling a little bit like Timothy and Paul just happened to drop in the church in Ephesus and feeling a little of that self-consciousness of having Brad back here. But it's a wonderful feeling. And Brad, I was saying also that Brad had mentioned being a bit of a Barnabas to me, and I think it's truly the case. What an encouragement you've been to me over the years. And so it's very meaningful having you here. I also want to say, Carlin, is Rachel here? But I just wanted to announce he's out there having a donut right now. But Carlin and Rachel just got married last Saturday, and I think that we should give them a hand. Yay, Carlin. Yay, Rachel. It was so fun, and so fun seeing them and back to record a record with Brad a week later. We've been studying 1 Timothy, and we, before that, were in 1 Peter. And both of these books are written, they're casting vision for the church, as the church is kind of over the initial boom that happened, that there at the resurrection of Jesus was like this bomb went off and the ripple effects are going out into the world. But as they're seeking to sustain that, as the church is understanding, okay, what does it mean for the church to be the church? What does it mean for that seed that was planted to take root? There's a process, and even as it turns out, a difficult process that begins at that point. And so you have a man like Peter telling the church about suffering and the importance of the work that God is doing. You have somebody like Paul saying to Timothy, like, you got to hang in there. You're going to have opposition. Stick with it. Keep going. Persevere. Paul's going to say, train like an athlete. Right? And so this idea of training for godliness, we've, I think, as a church in many ways, been having this vision cast for us through these books. And we decided over the summer to take a little bit more of an intense focus on that phrase, this idea of training in godliness. Let me read the passage from which it comes. This is in 1 Timothy 4, 7 through 10. Paul says, "Rather train yourself for godliness. For while bodily training is of some value, godliness is of value in every way, as it holds promise for the present life and also for the life to come. The saying is trustworthy and deserving of full acceptance. For to this end we toil and strive, because we have our hope set on the living God, who is the Savior of all people, especially of those who believe." And there's a lot packed into this. But this idea of training for godliness, this is not something where we stand up here saying, here, let me show you how to be godly, as much as we recognize, wow, we are all in this together. And in fact, it's God, the living God, drawing us towards that. That the fruit of that, the descriptions of that, are something that we're not just doing, but becoming. A certain type of person. And we call this discipleship. I mean, this is what Jesus did. Is he called people not to a religion, not to attend a certain church. He called people to a lifestyle, and it was a lifestyle of becoming a certain way, of living a life like Christ, of living by a set of rules that were described as his kingdom come to earth. And I like how he's saying, okay, we understand physical training. Now let's apply that to spiritual training. In fact, this is more important that we're doing this because it applies not just to this world, but in the world to come. And we could spend all day kind of unpacking what that means exactly. And I think a lot of it we have just yet to see. But this idea of physical training is an important metaphor and one that we can kind of get our hands around and is helpful because spiritual training, I think, is a lot harder to see. It's something that's taking place internally in the heart. And so the outward manifestations of it, well, let's just say we could kind of fake it a little bit. and avoid those sins Aquinas would call the fattening sins, the ones that show on the outside, right? So we go, well, I'm going to avoid alcohol so I'm not a stumbling drunk, and instead I'm going to live an intemperate life of online gambling or whatever that is, right? To go, we can hide one easier than we can hide the other. But God is so interested in our hearts and in developing that, the appetite similar to Christ, the manners similar to Christ, the obedience that just flows naturally out of us. I was thinking of Frank up there playing, and at one point he's looking through his sheet music as his foot's doing one thing and his hand's doing another, and thinking, this has become who Frank is over there on the drum, that he can look, you know, over here and is not worried what his other hand is doing. That kind of thing, that these things just become our hearts and who we are. I was thinking, and this, you know, I'm poking fun here a little bit, but thinking if Paul had almost reversed the metaphor and said, your physical regimen should look a lot like your spiritual lives, what that might look like for us. And I was thinking, you know, maybe we would say, yeah, I'm in shape because, look, I have this gym membership that I pay for, right? That might not be the most successful physical regimen there. Or, you know what, I'm really trying to watch what I eat. Like on Sunday mornings, I eat vegetables and drink water, and then the rest of the week, I just eat whatever I want. See what I mean? Or that we would say, you know what, I feel really, really good about like curling 15 pounds. I think I'm just going to stick with this weight for the rest of my life. That I can avoid some sort of hardship or discomfort that way, and this just feels really good. And the fact is that those things actually would send us the other way, right? That we know that if we want to be healthy, that it matters what we eat every day. That if we want to get stronger, that we got to be pushing ourselves. In fact, maybe lifting weight that we're not quite sure we can lift. Maybe we need somebody to stand there and spot us so that we can get that weight up, so that we can grow, so that we have vision for where we're going. And I think this is what Paul and what Peter are trying to say. That you're a new creation. There is new life. Something radical has happened, and yet there's a trajectory to this. And that there's vision required, that as we wake up each day, we understand, okay, there's a certain discipline. I wake up and I think, I don't really feel like working out today. And if you have vision, you go, I'm going to do it anyway. And spiritually applied, there's a certain way of living that we're applying ourselves towards each day so that we're becoming disciples of Christ. And I like this quote. This is from Robert Barron. Can we throw that first slide up if we got it? No, that's the last song. It's coming. There it is. He says, discipleship entails an entire reworking of the self according to the pattern and manner of Jesus. An entire reworking. This is what discipleship meant. It was this radical shift. Jesus would say these words. He would say, follow me. And these words, it was like a rabbi. It was a rabbi saying to somebody who was a potential student of his, you have what it takes. You have what it takes to do what I do. And so Jesus is intent on this. In fact, that was the commission to the church. Go make disciples. Go call people to a life that follows in the footsteps of Christ. One of my favorites of these, go ahead and put the next. Do you have a painting? This is a painting. I did this in honor of Brad Caravaggio. This is a calling. And can you see, I mean, the lighting I know is kind of tough. But does anybody recognize this and know who's being called here? Matthew. This is the calling of Matthew. And here you see what would have been a modern retelling of this. I think if we were seeing this today, these guys would be wearing suits. These would probably be like gangsters sitting in a bar. Here you've got these men huddled over a table, and they're tax collectors. And they're dressed here in 16th century garb, but they've got swords, there's money piled on the table. We're about to lose the overhead projector because of the temperature. That's what that means in the bottom corner. So I better talk fast. You've got Jesus back in the shadow. pointing. And you've got Matthew, isn't this brilliant? He's going, me? So good. That story, Matthew talks about his calling in his gospel that he writes. And it says, as Jesus passed on from there, he saw a man called Matthew sitting in a tax booth. And he said to him, follow me. And he rose and followed him. And there's it. There's Matthew's calling in a nutshell. Except that something radically changes in Matthew to the point where in the very next line, all Matthew's friends are showing up at a party going, we want what he got, right? And you're talking about guys who really, in many ways, have no hope. They have, in a sense, sold out their country to the Romans to make a profit. So these guys are despised by everybody. And you think of probably the fear underneath that that would make you respond in such a way, the view of the world that you would have to choose that as kind of your tactic. This is how I'm going to get through life, is I'm just going to rob from both sides. And yet these guys, this deeper meaning that they're longing for, this hunger. And so they show up and it says, and as Jesus reclined at the table in the house, behold, many tax collectors and sinners came and were reclining with Jesus and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? But when he heard it, he said, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice, for I came not to call the righteous, but sinners. Isn't that great? And, you know, I mean, this kind of calling, it helps us understand this is a calling to all. And so he's telling us, look, you need to set your eyes on things above. That those who are blind, you know, like those who have eyes to see, let them see. So this idea of expanding our vision, I love how Jesus says to the Pharisees, here, you know what, go think about this, right? Let this one sit, let this one soak in. Because the fact is that the Pharisees, as difficult a time as they had coming and accepting Christ and were even opposed to it, ended up in Acts coming in droves to know Christ. Jesus is drawing all these to himself. There are two things going on, I think, with the call to discipleship, at least two I want to focus on today. The first is this translation that Jesus is constantly doing, helping them see real life, helping them see greater reality, casting things in light of a greater meaning. Wealth and success and power and all of these things. We have a way that we understand that in a sort of grasping to hold on to those things. And so we're constantly being taught to let go, to submit, to entrust our lives to Christ, to live our life by faith and not by sight. And this ongoing process, I think, is one that when applied to our own life, has a sort of softening to our hearts. And I think about the people that I end up respecting the most, the people at the end of their life and where they are. There's often a softening and a humility. I love that when you have these guys at the end of their life saying, oh, I just have so many questions, right? Because it's just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I'm thinking of John Stott, and here's this brilliant theologian at the end of his life saying, you know, I have more questions than answers, but this is not any sort of regression back. It's this expansion of the world getting bigger and bigger and bigger as Jesus is pulling us further and further into eternity. And so we're in this position of reading the signs, and God is constantly giving us signs and symbols of what he's doing if we have the eyes to see those. I love how he says to the Pharisees, he says, look, you guys, you know, you can say it'll be fair weather for the sky is red, and in the morning it will be stormy today for the sky is red and threatening. You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the signs of the times. And having the eyes to see what God is doing, what he's up to, because we can miss it if we're not looking carefully. And so I think a big part of discipleship is learning to just simply see where God is at work. Having the eyes to see, not just randomly picking some assignment that we want to apply ourselves to, but a sense of obedience to the calling, where he is calling us. I love this. We're going at the end of
this month, we're going to go see that play for The Great Divorce. And that's one of my favorite stories of all. So in honor of that, I have just a couple quotes. But this one is from one of the people that is there. And we probably don't have a projection. So I'll just read it to you. It'll be even better that way. The Great Divorce is about these people taking a bus ride from hell to heaven to check it out. And the majority, just to spoil the story, the majority want to go back, right? And that's kind of the, like, what? Why would that happen? Except they're these phantoms. They get off and they're transparent. And they're stepping on grass that's like, hurts their feet. It's so painful because it's so real. Eternity is so real. And there's this sense of like, I just want to go back where I'm comfortable. And then you have these guides. They're the angels and people that have been dwelling in heaven that are there to help them in. But often there's such an offense that comes because they have to humbly put their arm around somebody and be led into heaven, which to me is the posture anyways. But this one lady, she says to her guide, I wish I had never been born. What are we born for? And this angel says to her, for infinite happiness, you can step out into it at any moment. And we think, well, why wouldn't we? And yet there's this offense to our pride because of this self-reliance and this desire to want to do it ourselves that like lurks at the bottom of every single fear and every single sin is this self thing in there, this thing that resists, that wants to do it its own way. And so the second part of discipleship, and this is vital, this helps us understand what is going on for the rest of our lives, is that not only are we drawn into this new meaning of life, but we're drawn into a process of transformation. That at the moment of salvation, something radical happens and a heart is changed, and yet there is a growing that begins to take place in that. And as we talk about discipleship, becoming like Christ, it's having the mind of Christ, it's having the heart of Christ. These are the things that he's doing. He's always already doing those things in our life. And all we have to do is step into it. I like this idea of transformation. I read this. Somebody said, you know, Jesus did not come to comfort the self, but to dismantle it. Isn't that good? But this is part of what discipleship is a dismantling of certain ways of doing things. For instance, I think in myself that I have a really hard time just completely going with God's plan. And so what I do is I come up with all these little contingency plans of my own, these little backup plans. So like if God shows up, we're going, that's plan A. If he doesn't show up, here's plan B. And these little ways of kind of living our lives. And I think God gently puts up with those things for a while in us. But I think he's constantly also reshaping those patterns, giving us a new mind, giving us a new heart. James says, be doers of the word and not hearers only. And I think James knew that there's a tendency on our part to just latch on to ideas, but to not actually implement those things, which is, again, why this training in godliness has this sort of daily taking up your cross, daily applying yourself. It takes effort, right? We've talked about this before, that this is Dallas Willard's line, that it's... This gospel is opposed to earning, but it's not opposed to effort. In fact, over and over it's saying, you know, set your mind on the task, right? Focus on Christ and run that race to win. I think James reminds us of that. Look, that this kind of change, when it's working, when we're growing, when those seeds are going deeper and deeper, what we see is fruit. The fruit that is born, that fruit of gentleness and love, is generosity, self-control, these things that pour out of us, gentleness. I think without this perspective of transforming, we have a hard time understanding what God is doing, especially when we're suffering, and especially when we suffer for any period of time. And immediately our question becomes, okay, God, what are you doing here? I thought you said that you're a God of comfort. I thought you said that in you I have victory, in you I have freedom. Why am I still struggling? I think that often God will set us free from things immediately, but I think oftentimes too, he lets us struggle. And why? Well, I like how in Hebrews, the author is writing about this almost being like a parent disciplining their child. that the difficulties we face show like the tension of a father or a mother to their children. It says, it is for discipline, this is Hebrews 12, it is for discipline that you have to endure. God is treating you as sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? If you are left without discipline, in which all have participated, then you are illegitimate children, not sons. Besides this, we have had earthly fathers who disciplined us and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as it seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. For the moment of all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. This peaceful fruit of righteousness. You know, to think about, this is the work, when Paul tells us in 1 Timothy, for this life and also for the life to come, that this work of the heart is one that endures. This is a description of your heart, this peaceful heart of righteousness. This is the work God is doing. And that sometimes when we face trials, this is what is going on. Even in those trials that we face unjustly, even in those difficulties that are not our fault or the result of someone else's sin. Lewis says that God comes in and exploits that evil for the sake of the good. Isn't that a great word? He exploits it, that sin doesn't get the final word, that God goes, there's nothing that could come against you that I can't turn around and use for your good for eternity. And while we wait, we grow. And so when things aren't happening, when we look at the timeline and go, okay, God, now would be a good time. And I think sometimes he does. I think of times where God has so brilliantly answered my prayer in the moment. And then I think of plenty of other times where he hasn't. And I've thought, God, now would have been a good time. But he has just this brilliant timing of his own where he's saying, trust me. What I need you to do, Jeff, is not control this, not force this. I need you to release this, right? So that open-handedness becomes the posture of a disciple that's saying, not my will, but yours be done. This is how we receive. So discipleship is this receptivity to God's grace. And I think that takes effort. Because if you're like me, I keep clutching on. And so the work is almost like prying my fingers off of it. This from The Great Divorce. It says, good beats upon the damned incessantly as sound waves beat on the ears of the deaf, but they cannot receive it. Their fists are clenched, their teeth are clenched, their eyes fast shut. First they will not, in the end they cannot open their hands for the gifts or their mouth for food or their eyes to see. So this salvation is just being poured out on all. Right? But the posture there, this teeth clenched. And God is saying, trust me, I want you to open up your hands to this. But it's counterintuitive in many ways. I love how Henry Nouwen talks about the way of Christ as a way of downward mobility, where he's saying the things that you give up are the things to be spectacular and to be powerful and to be relevant. He's saying, these are the temptations where we go, no, Lord. I'll go where you want me to go. I'm not going to seek these things, right? Those are the things that are perpetuating the self. Those are the things that keep us small. And God is saying, I want you to be set free from that. So Henry Nouwen's drawn from his Ivy League role out to a handicapped community in Canada called L'Arche, where he serves as a chaplain and basically ministers to handicapped people. What comes out of that is writing of such depth of the heart, right? This is the way of Christ. I love this in 1 Corinthians. It says, for consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. And because of him, you are in Christ Jesus, who became to us wisdom from God, righteousness and sanctification and redemption, so that as it is written, let the one who boasts boast in the Lord. I've been meeting with a spiritual director for the last couple years, and what she is another set of eyes for me. I sit there and I go, gosh, these five random things happened, this and this and this and this. Isn't that weird, you know, and this? What do I do with these? And so often what Lynn ends up doing for me is going, oh, look. Look at this arc. Look at this trajectory. Look at the way that God is weaving something together here. And remember what you said this last time. Gosh, you were longing for this. And look at how God is doing this. And she'll often just say, isn't he brilliant? And it's true, he is. I mean, God is brilliant at this if we pay attention. He's brilliant if we don't pay attention. But he's brilliant. The brilliance, to see the brilliance. And I was thinking about this, that that word is not accidental. I think we look at brilliance and we think intelligent, gifted, successful. And I think that God looks at brilliance and says, like, illumined, right? That when God comes in and takes the simple things and redeems them, they shine bright, brilliant. So each one of you is brilliant, or at least has the potential to be. But it's not based on really anything we bring to the equation, right? We never are self-illuminating. When we do, it takes something away from the strength of the message that's being shown. When our hands are open, when that posture is just simply one of obedience, when our will is subjected, that is when God goes, okay, I can shine through this full strength and let the world see. And this is our goal. I love how Matthew writes these words of Jesus. He says, you are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand. And it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. And see, this is such a powerful thing that's happening. As God comes in and calls us, he gives our life new meaning. As that meaning takes root, it transforms who we are. As that transformation takes place, it is giving meaning to all those around us. And people are looking at that going, okay, how does that work? Right? Which is that's the whole apologetic First Peter is teaching us. Peter's saying, be ready when people come up and go, okay, where does that hope come from? Be ready and give an answer with gentleness and with respect. They see a life that is filled with the love of God, with the selflessness of God, with the joy of God, with the kindness of God. So this new creation that takes place, so much of it is in this brilliant instant, and yet there is a process as well. Like Peter tells us, our salvation is being kept for us in heaven. There's a work that's happening that in many ways is like us being in a cocoon right now. There's a change that's begun, and I think that helps us understand why so often we have to wait, that in the waiting there's growing, in the waiting there's transformation, but there is literally something new happening in you, a new creation. And as Jesus says later in Revelation, behold, I make all things new. I think God takes us further and further in, and really in the end, that's what this life on earth offers to us. Is this potential to go further and further in? And I say this only for some of you who are sitting there thinking, gosh, you know, I'm still struggling with this, or I feel like I've hit a wall, or, you know, gosh, this was working and now it's not working. And I think that this happens to us in life as a part of the process. This is not all of a sudden God being distant, or if he is distant, why? And I think that there's some of the depth of this happens for us when we're moving through those sort of phases. There's a verse in Isaiah where God says, I will give you the treasures of darkness and the hoards in the secret places, that you may know that it is I, the Lord, the God of Israel, who call you by your name. And so discipleship, this idea of being drawn in, is a drawing in to the mysteries of God. into the depths of God, I think we will spend eternity understanding, seeking to understand the depths of who God is. There's a prayer by St. Francis where he says, just these simple two questions. He would wake up and say, who are you, O God? And who am I? I think discipleship in many ways, that's it in a nutshell. That God continues to grow. And as God continues to grow in our minds, our understanding of ourself is affected and changes and shifts. And as our selves grow, our understanding of God grows. I can't help it. There's this in the second Narnia book, Prince Caspian, Lewis talks about Lucy seeing the lion and going, you're bigger. And the lion says, no, you're bigger. And I think there it is, right? There's this picture of discipleship. As we grow, God grows.